of us are familiar with the story of Joseph. Excuse me. It's a story of intense drama. The highs and lows of Joseph's life are as great as any other experience in the biblical record. There are times of great joy and times of great sorrow, times of prison and times of promotion, times of temptation and times of triumph, times of gut-wrenching heartache and times of glorious hope. The story of Joseph has had a profound impact on the people of God ever since the very first day it was penned. And I'm greatly looking forward to what it's simply going to do in my own heart over these next couple of months as we have an opportunity to study out the drama of the life of this man, Joseph. Now, let me start this morning with a story that you may remember from a few years back. Jessica McClure. You remember that name? She was only 18 months old. When she was playing in the backyard of her aunt's daycare in Midland, Texas, unbeknownst to the aunt, there was an abandoned well in the backyard. And unbeknownst to Jessica, the ground just immediately gave way and she went plunging down 30 feet into that abandoned well. Rescue workers were immediately called, and for the next 58 hours, they worked frantically trying to rescue Jessica. But because the diameter of that well was so small, they had to dig another hole parallel to the well in order to get somebody down there to reach Jessica. Finally, when the hole was big enough, it was rescue worker Robert O'Donnell who was lowered down 30 feet until he was finally able to reach over into that kind of broken, disintegrated well shaft and touch Jessica. But just at that moment when he was attempting to rescue her, the well shaft collapsed even further and Jessica went down, plunging even deeper into the earth. They pulled O'Donnell out of the hole that they had dug, and they begin to rethink their strategy as to how they could rescue this little girl. At that moment, the pediatrician who had been called to come to the scene, he gave these urgent words, "Whatever you do, you better do it quickly, because she won't last much longer down there." So they lowered O'Donnell back in again. And he began to frantically dig through the rock into the dirt until he was able again to reach out and touch Jessica. But unable to pull that tiny girl from the rubble that had entrapped her, and really not sure what to do next, O'Donnell heard a muted cry from 45 feet or so above on the surface. The cry was from O'Donnell's supervisor. And he said this, "O'Donnell, pull hard, for you may have to break her in order to save her." So he began to pull hard, agonizing as he did, knowing that he was hurting Jessica terribly. He could hear her screams and her moans and her cries and her groans as he kept pulling harder and harder. In doing so, he damaged one of Jessica's toes. He severely scraped both the front of her face and the back of her head. Interestingly, as O'Donnell pulled and remembered those words, "You may have to break her in order to save her," when he finally rescued Jessica and they both were back on the surface, no one accused O'Donnell of being a child abuser, though they had to amputate one of the toes that was damaged as he pulled her out. No one accused O'Donnell of being unnecessarily rough with Jessica, though they had to do reconstructive surgery not only on the face but the back of her head and both ears. You see, everyone knew that if he did not scar her, he could not save her. Now, beloved, let me just stop for a moment and ask you a question. Do you have a category in your mind? Do you have a category in your theology of God for a scenario like that? Well, I ask you for this reason. Because every now and then, the ground beneath us gives way, forcing us to endure something so severe that it scars us. You say, but why? I mean, why would God ever do such a thing? The answer is to save you. And maybe to save others along with you as well. And understand, I'm not talking about your initial experience of salvation alone. When you put your faith in Jesus Christ, your sins were forgiven and you became a child of God. But I'm also speaking of the entirety of the salvation experience, the sanctification experience, till we arrive in glory and we are like Jesus Christ. So that's the question this morning. Do your categories for God include this kind of thinking? Of course, part of the problem is we live in such a time in our nation where so much of the Christian evangelical church is all about self-fulfillment. It's all about successful living and satisfying relationships and selfish gratification. And the problem is when the ground gives way beneath us and life is imploding all around us, many Christians today find themselves without any theological category to sustain their faith in the midst of the storms of life. This is the story of the life of Joseph. I tell you, it's as if one day he was a young boy walking with a just through life, happy-go-lucky, and all of a sudden as he walked to the field of life, the ground below him gave way. And in a moment's time, everything that he had counted on for 17 years to bring comfort and joy and security and hope, it was all just ripped away in a moment. And brethren, listen. What we must understand this morning is that this is not an unusual happening in the life of the people of God. You think about that young wife, Ruth, who lost her dear husband at a young age. And young David, who was forced to flee from the palace as a young man and live in the barren wilderness for 13 years. Daniel, who was ripped away from his mom and dad as a young teenage boy. Hosea, whose unfaithful wife brought him shame and incredible grief and heartache. You think about the Apostle Paul, whose frequent beatings and imprisonments are too much for us to even count. We think of the Apostle John, who in his old age, at the age of 90, when he needed family around him for comfort and help and support, he was banished away to a prison island in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. That's not even speaking of Job, by the way. Beloved, at some time in the life of every child of God, the ground below us gives way without warning, and we find ourselves falling in the ditch of despair with no hope to rescue ourselves on our own. That's the story of the life of Joseph. And what we're going to find is that this young man fell further in and deeper down than anyone could have ever imagined. And yet we're also going to find this, that every inch of the way that Joseph fell was measured out precisely by a good and sovereign God. And as horrible and heartbreaking as Joseph's fall was, it was all orchestrated by a loving heavenly Father who found it necessary to break Joseph in order to save Joseph. Save him from himself, as we'll see, and save others around him as well. This is a story, by the way, that biblical scholars have referred to for centuries as the best Old Testament illustration of Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. And we know that in all things, God is working His good in the life of His children, for they are called according to a great, sovereign, sanctifying purpose, and that's to be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. It all begins right here in Genesis 37. And it's going to last 20 long years in the life of Joseph before it's ever resolved. That's 20 years of scarring, 20 years of pulling and breaking, all resulting in this magnificent spiritual deliverance of Joseph, of all of his family, of the nation of Israel as a whole, and believe it or not, of you as well. Now, what we find here in our chapter is a picture of hatred. And I've kind of broken the hatred down into three parts. So let's kind of address this chapter that way. There's a crisis of hatred in the life of the covenant family. Number one, we see hatred growing. Verse 1, now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned in the land of Canaan, and these are the records of the generations of Jacob. By the time we get to chapter 37, Jacob's an old man. He's been through many trials in his life. We know that. We've been coming to Sunday school. But now in his mind, he has settled down to his final few years of retirement, and in his mind, he's thinking that all of his trials are behind him. Well, in our story, Jacob's about to be rudely awakened. The ground beneath him is about to give way unexpectedly. And the cause is hatred. Specifically, the hatred of Jacob's 10 older sons to his favorite son, Joseph. Let me give you four ways which we see this hatred develop. Number one, because of multiple wives, verse 2. Joseph was 17 years of age. He was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah, those are his brothers, and the sons of Zilpah, those are his brothers, his father's wives. So take note of the family of Jacob. He has 12 sons. Benjamin is still a baby. He's not on the scene yet. So there's Joseph and 10 older brothers. There's daughters as well. The problem is, with all of these children, they all don't come from the same mom, but they actually come from four different moms. There is Rachel, there's Leah, and then there's the two handmaids, Bilhah and Zilpah. And just to be blunt, the handmaids, Bilhah and Zilpah, they were at the very bottom of the pecking order when it came to Jacob's love and affection, and unfortunately, so were their children as well. And who was at the top of that list? Well, it was none other than the only woman that Jacob ever really loved. Her name was Rachel. And you remember when God finally opened her womb after waiting for years and years and praying for years and years, and God finally gave her a son, Joseph. He became the object of Daddy's greatest affection. And believe me, everybody knew it as well. Well, that kind of favoritism breeds something in the life of a child who's the recipient of it. There's a sense of self-superiority, a sense of self-centeredness, and right here it's going to transform Daddy's favorite son into his little tattletale. Look at the end of verse 2. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them, his brothers, to their father. Now you might ask the question, what's wrong with this? It's the Hebrew term bad report. It carries with it the idea of intentional slander. Even manipulation of ideas and deception with words, purposely trying to bring reproach upon another. It infers that the report that Joseph gave to his father Jacob was to cast his brothers in a bad light. The worst possible light. So the picture here is of Joseph as a self-centered tattletale. Someone who sees himself as superior to others, and he seeks to exalt himself by tearing down others. So we begin to see this hatred growing over the years, because Jacob had multiple wives, and he favored one wife, and he favored one child from that one wife, and everybody else became jealous. A second way that hatred grows is through superior love. Look at verse 3. Now Israel, that's another name for Jacob. That's his new name, Israel. So it's speaking of Jacob. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons. Well, that explains it right there, right? And listen, of all people, you would have thought that Jacob would have known better. Because if you remember the story, he actually was his mother's favorite. His brother Esau was his father's favorite. And that favoritism brought such schism in the family that there was deceit and manipulation and even murder on the minds of one of the brothers because of this favoritism. And you probably know that family patterns can leave a lasting impression. And that's exactly what we'd find with Jacob here, kind of like father, like son, like mother, like child. And now as we come to our story, Joseph's 10 older brothers now, they're mature men. They're in their 20s and in their 30s. They have families and they're raising those families. And they've had to live with their father's favoritism of Joseph for 17 long years now. 17 years ago, a special package was dropped in the doorstep, you would say, of Jacob when Rachel was able to bear this first son, a son of his most beloved wife. And the child becomes, you see, verse 3, because he was the son of his old age. That's what we call a term of endearment. Moses gives this bit of information on purpose. The son of his old age. It's another way of saying he's his favorite son. You can just picture Jacob and his favorite son, Joseph, always sharing private secrets together, kind of laughing and giggling together, constant companions, best buds throughout all these years. And the other sons, they can't help but notice. Dad never spent this kind of time with us. Dad was never this indulgent with us. Boy, he's not nearly as strict with Joseph as he is with us. And on it went. He treats him more like a grandfather than he is his dad. And maybe sometimes at the beginning it was rather amusing to the brothers, but over time, believe me, as we're going to see, it began to wear on them, and it seemed like it was this way for 17 long years. And when you consider all of that, it's not hard to imagine the deep resentment and intense bitterness that began to develop in the heart of these brothers. A third way this hatred grew was through special favor. Look at the end of verse 3. And he, Jacob, made him, Joseph, a varied colored tunic. Now listen, there is more to this than Jacob making Joseph a multicolored robe. We're going to see that. You see, the garment in itself was special. You see, the ancient culture, it was a working class environment. And most of the work was done under the burning heat of the hot Middle Eastern sun. And the garments that the men wore in those days, they were simple burlap garments where a couple of holes were cut out for the arms, one for the head. You sewed it together, you threw it over, and that was it. There was no fashion statements back then. But this garment was different. It not only was full of different colors, But the kind of wording here, it depicts a garment of a superior, maybe even royalty. For instance, the sleeves were long. It gives the idea of long sleeves, which is more a picture of someone who is an authority than a normal working class individual. Maybe if I could illustrate it, it's like a guy showing up for a construction site with a $5,000 suit. Well, he didn't come as a day laborer. He must own the company. And get this, because the word is used elsewhere in the Old Testament of royalty, this kind of garment, the message that Jacob is sending to Joseph's 10 older brothers is this, that in my mind, Joseph is exalted over the rest of you. And there's no doubt they understood this. Look at the way they respond to Joseph, verse 4. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, so they hated him. How deep did this hatred run? The end of verse 4, they could not even speak to him on friendly terms. I mean, they can't even bring themselves to look upon Joseph. Every time his name comes up, the intensity of the anger begins to burn within them. When they have to speak his name, it's like poison is coming out of their lips. In the secret of their hearts, they imagined the joy it would bring them to do great harm to this favorite son. I mean, that would be something that would bring us satisfaction. That would bring us great joy. And just know this. The direction of their rage was not focused on the one who did the favoring, who gave the robe. Instead, it was on the one who was favored. Make no mistake, and we're going to see this, Jacob's 10 sons loved their father deeply. They just couldn't stand his favored son. That brings us to the fourth aspect of this growing hatred, the fourth instigator, and that is divine favor. Look at verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream. Now, this isn't just any dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. So their bitterness towards their brother has been building through the years. In verse 4, they can't speak to him, and now they hate him even more. And it's building and it's smoldering like a volcano that could burst at any moment. And it's about to get worse. Look at verse 6. He said to them, this is Joseph said to them, please listen to the dream which I've had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and stood erect, and behold, and your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Now, it never says here that Joseph interpreted the dream for them, but to be honest, it's so obvious it doesn't need interpretation. Look at verse 8. Then his brother said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for the dreams and for his words. Why do they hate him even more? Well, look at what the text says. For his dreams. So the gift of the robe increased the hatred, but at least the gift came from the father whom they loved. But the dream, it takes their hatred to an entirely new level. You say, why is that? Because the dream might possibly be from God himself. It's one thing to have their beloved father favor Joseph, but it's a whole other thing to have God put his stamp of approval on his despised brother. And not only that, if the dream is real, then the dream's prophetic of what's to come. And if it's prophetic of what's to come, that's something these brothers are unwilling to accept. You understand this, right? Even people back then hated the doctrine of election. So now they hate Jacob even more for his dream. And get this, you see the word is dreams, plural, which implies that Jacob was insistent on talking about these dreams over and over again, incessantly. Let me tell you about my dream. I had another dream. At the end of the day, in the mind of the brothers, this is nothing short of bragging. Boasting about his own exaltation. Verse 9. Now he had still another dream and related it to his brothers. I mean, why does he go ahead and tell them this new dream if he knows how much they despise him for the old dream? Well, I would say at least in part, it is all part of the self-absorption that comes with being the father's favorite son. Joseph is not only a tattletale, but evidently he is self-centered as well. The end of verse 9, and he said, lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon, that would be Jacob and his wife Rachel, and the 11 stars, that would be the brothers, were bowing down to me. And he related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come and bow ourselves down before you in the ground? Notice you could just begin to feel the heat of the blaze of the brothers' hatred becoming hotter and hotter here. In verse 4, they hated him. They could not speak peaceably to him. In verse 5, they hated him even more. In verse 8, they hated him even more. Now in verse 11, his brothers were jealous of him. The word jealous speaks of a passion that is so filled with rage that it's soon likely to break out in violence, destruction. What we have here is a picture of Cain and Abel all over again. And what was Jacob's response to all this? The end of verse 12, but his father, that's Jacob, kept this saying in his mind. Joseph's bragging notwithstanding, Jacob recognized that this would not have been the first time that God would have exalted a younger son over older brothers. I mean, that was something Jacob himself knew all too well, right? If you know the story. I mean, you could just hear Jacob thinking to himself, might God be at it again? Now, let me just stop and say at this point, what a messed up family this is, and we have seen this for chapters. I mean, favoritism, envy, quarreling, hatred. And listen, here's what I want you to get. This is the covenant family. And yet they are so profoundly dysfunctional. You have the favored boy, the foolish father, and the furious brothers. Let me ask you this question. Who are you in this story? Are you the child who was loved too much like Joseph? Are you the father who favored one too much like Jacob? Or are you the child who was loved too little like the brothers? Listen, don't you ever think that yours is the only messed up family? And don't you ever think that God can't bring something wonderfully good out of such a dysfunctional family like this? Just in case you're thinking, Pastor, you don't have a clue. My family is 10 times worse than this. I would simply say, are you sure? You may want to stick around a little while we go through the rest of the chapter. That brings us to our second point. So hatred growing. Now let's see hatred in action. The volcano's about to explode. Verse 12. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Remember, the family of Jacob, they were shepherds. Verse 13, Jacob said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Now, wait a minute. If you've been with us in the book of Genesis, then the name Shechem would sound familiar because it was just a few years earlier that Jacob's sons had a violent and bloody conflict in Shechem. You could read all about it in chapter 34 if you're interested. And please understand that the author Moses, he just doesn't drop the name Shechem here as some sort of geographical location. That's not the point. Yes, the older sons are in Shechem, but Moses gives the name three times, by the way, here, as a literary device to remind the listeners of what happened the last time those boys were in Shechem. I mean, last time they were in the area of Shechem, they were so filled with rage. They slaughtered a whole city of people in hatred and vengeance. And this is Moses' way of telling us that Jacob knew that. Of course he did. We went through the story. And he no doubt also knew how the older sons felt about his favorite son, Joseph. And yet he speaks these words to Joseph, the end of verse 13. And he said to him, well, come, and I will send you to them. Well, wait a minute, Jacob, what in the world are you thinking here? I mean, are you out of your mind? Jacob, are you not aware of the danger that lurks in the region of Shechem? Are you not aware of the vengeance that broke out in the hearts of your older sons last time they were in Shechem? And you're going to send Joseph to meet them in Shechem? You know how they feel about Joseph? What are you thinking, Jacob? At the end of verse 13, Joseph said to Jacob, I will go. And then he said to him, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock and bring back word to me. I mean, you have to wonder at this point if Jacob is just clueless. He's an old man and maybe he has simply forgotten about the vengeance of his oldest sons just a few years earlier. By naming Shechem as the geographical location three different times in these verses, Moses is indicating to the readers that Jacob should have known better. He should not have been sending his son Joseph into the lion's den of these angry brothers whose hatred always sprung into action when they were in Shechem, so it seemed.